Hello, and welcome to the Gallery of Readers podcast. I'm Carol Edelstein, and along with Robin Barber, a co-founder of Gallery of Readers. We are a nonprofit small press that organizes a reading series every year. Our press has published 21 books which feature local authors. Today, we're turning the tables, and our beloved interviewer and podcast maven, Larkin Pazanova, has agreed to be interviewed and to read for us. Larkin is ordinarily the host of this podcast. Thanks so much for being here, Larkin. Larkin, what a pleasure to have you here with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
What is happening in your writing life right now?
Right now, I'm getting to work up a limited series podcast with a close friend of mine that's also going to be an audiobook. It chronicles a trip that we took to sacred sites connected to the divine feminine in Europe last October that became something of a pilgrimage. We had the most magical time, and it's been so educational to get to work it up into a 10-episode story that we get to share with the world.
That just sounds fascinating. I can't wait. Would you tell me a bit about your writing process?
Oh, yeah. I'm a little dyslexic, so I don't actually read very well. And to figure out how to write, I've had to get pretty creative to find tricks and tools to get me there. And it's actually been really satisfying in the last couple years to figure out small things that make a huge difference, like handwriting first to slow myself down and writing everything in a 3-ring binder so that I can write a story out of order and just work on whatever is most prominent in my mind that day, but then have the manuscript still be in order and then transcribe it and edit while I'm transcribing. And then when I read, I'll do voices or accents or atmospheric sounds and always try to focus on the rhythm and the melody and think like I'm sight reading music. And that makes it really engaging and accessible to me.
It sounds like it's fun to do.
It's so much fun. Yeah.
And where do you get your ideas?
I love mythology. I love psychology. I'm really interested in the way that storytelling has been a kind of therapy for humanity since it began. And I think a lot of my ideas come from my internal process, what I'm studying in the moment about meditation or cultural consciousness, also just what happens to me. I feel really privileged to have led a very interesting life. I've never been bored.
Wow. Well, I'm very eager to hear your selections today, and also curious. It seems like you're very involved in the world of podcasting. I mean, that's how we got you. What drew you to this medium?
I love music. I studied music in college. And then during the pandemic, I was having just a really hard time not being able to play out with people. But I got curious about audio recording because it was something I could do alone from home. And I stumbled on Audible's audition website and was recording things on my phone for fun and accidentally got a book offer. So I was like, well, I better learn how to do this. And then it kind of took off, but I've been really enjoying the process of listening and editing and getting to interview people and the community and the open-heartedness of people coming to share their work with so much courage and vulnerability and generosity. Yeah, it's really quickly become a great love in my life.
Well, that's just wonderful. And this is a perfect opportunity for me to just say that the the feedback that I've been getting from the writers that you've interviewed is stellar. You know, people mm-hmm. who are, some of whom, you know, have been reticent to go on air, have really enjoyed the interviewing and the reading and the whole process of coming aboard the podcast, which, you know, you've facilitated that, and it's really been a great experience for people.
I'm so glad. I'm loving it more than I can ever say. It's so rare to have such a high number of people in this area who write because it's important to them and have this relationship with it that's so inspiring and nurtured. And it's just such a joy to get to have a moment with them and hear what they've worked on.
Well, I so agree with you. And I have learned over many years of loving writing that the writing part is just one half of the process. And if you don't share and hear, it's not fully realized. And so it's just a pleasure to be able to have this medium for sharing.
Yeah, I'm so grateful to you and Robin and all that you've done with Gallery of Readers to nurture that value. It's really inspiring what you've done to make that a priority. The first thing I'll read is an excerpt from the first draft of a novel I've been working on, currently titled The Selkie. There is a kind of darkness at the heart of a storm that makes reality dissolve. What's moving and what's static? Time stretches, then slams forward all at once. There's so much sound, it's silent. So much darkness that lightning doesn't illuminate but blinds. The black air breaks into myriad colors, and anything that could hold a person steady, or for a moment catch them, has already ricocheted skyward in a rageful denouncement of gravity. In this particular storm, the sea pitched and swelled to match the waterfall tumbling downwards. The boy in his little boat had never seen a storm like this one. He'd thought he could trust the sea. Now he'd forgotten where he was or why and how he'd got there. He couldn't have told you his name had you thought to ask. All that mattered was the boat and his continual need to breathe. He felt entirely alone. But he was not, in fact, alone. Also alive in the frigid chaos of that night was a dear friend of mine who was, at that time, a seal. When she was little more than a wriggly, fuzzy cub, the elders of my friend's people told stories every night. Though in their language, it's so much more than telling. They speak mainly with the body, with energy and pure mind all coalescing and transforming in a symphony of communion. They dream sing their history, and my friend said she could always feel it awaken in the marrow of her bones like sparks on striking flint. Ancient mysteries rolled cacophonous through her, and she shivered, eager and just a bit frightened. Once, when she was old enough to be consumed by the question and young enough to ask it, she pressed up close to her grandmother seal and asked, "Why do we live in the sea?" Her grandmother chuckled and clucked, both chiding and comforting in that way of the true elders. "Is there anywhere else to be?" she queried the child in her lap. "There are so many who live on land." Her grandmother nodded thoughtfully. She tilted her head and sized up her young one. It was early, but it was time. "We share a kinship with the land folk," she said, still in that way both bitter and sweet. "Really?" The child twisted to make sure there was no tricksterish glint in her grandmother's eyes. When she saw only peace and the usual dark brown of those eyes, she was disappointed and relieved. Her gaze wandered over the face above her, crinkled and worn through with rough wind and strong tides. The seal girl imagined salt crystals crusting along those lines and crabs hiding in the crevices, just like how they scuttle through slits between rocks and poke up their tiny pearl eyes. Her grandmother was as much water and light as skin and bone those days. The old seal smiled, watching her grandbaby lost in distraction. "You have heard it told," she said, then let out a deep sigh and took in another great breath, the kind that travels down through dust and stone and carrion into the very earth. The child woke up a bit, knowing that something exciting always followed that kind of breath, and adjusted her position so they could both more easily nestle into the rocking chair of their bones. The ocean would help her grandmother tell it, not something to do alone. One more inhale and the sound of the waves made both of their earlobes tingle. Exhale and the sky came dazzling alive with cascading golden stars. The wind flickered and twisted, brushing over silk-smooth shores and rugged, ugly cliffsides, bringing music and life. The story was ready and waiting. As her grandmother started to speak, to tell the tale the girl had unknowingly requested, the unseen world lying just under this one gradually revealed itself, like a flower gently unfurling in the soft, yellow glow of the sun. What the girl could always see became just a touch more transparent, and a hidden universe underneath blended its way into view. All of creation listened then, or at least all that could hear. The ocean breeze and the old mother seal wove a ballad of magic and power. How there came to be Selkies, wondrous creatures that they are. Yes, she spoke of the Selkies, the people who look like seals most of the time, but can shed their skins and be humans. They live mostly in the north, in salt-washed, harsh-winded places, where volcano glass shores meet glacial tides and stars outshine daylight in winter. She explained why Selkies live separate from the only humans, how exactly they shed their skin, why they do it, and when. I would truly love to repeat it, but I have not earned that right. Once I underestimated the sharpness of a story and it nearly cost me my life. So please forgive my caution and wait for the truthful telling from one who knows what power they carry and can manage it well. Though I love to wonder, what does it feel like when a Selkie slips off their skin? A banana being peeled? Struggling out of a soaked through coat after a long walk in pouring rain? Most likely, I would guess it feels a bit like a baby does, sliding out of the womb. Certainly, there must be a kind of smoothness, the assistance of muscles contracting, ligaments stretched. It's magic, pure magic. And how do they get it back on? That's even more of a mystery. The only thing I know to say for sure is that there's something of the seal that remains in the skin, and something of the human that wasn't there before. The soul, though, the gravitas in those dark brown, timeless eyes, that withstands any transformation. The seal child had indeed heard this story before, but she listened in a first-time kind of way. That's the magic of the really good stories. They greet us like new every time we invite those scraggly, rough-hewn faces to venture up into the light of our minds. They participate in every telling, breathing hot with excitement and love, shifting their weight just so to perch balanced on our knees, adjusting and transfiguring to be precisely what we need. Then, softly wiping salty tears from warm, astonished faces with gnarled, long-fingered hands, gazing at our imperfections with the kind of whole-bellied compassion known only to those few who have seen ages slipped by and felt, beyond all questioning, the unspeakable truths of the world. These are the stories to look for. These stories rarely get stuck. Many seasons later, in that terrible storm, the same little grandchild was nearly grown and pressed a body against her chest just like she'd been cradled. The boy had been thrown from his boat, which smashed against the rocks, and in a madness of compassion, she had tugged him with her teeth across the waves. On the sandy beach, she found it surprisingly easy to scare away hesitation and shed her sealskin. Easy in a way that would occur in memories later as something uncomfortable and strange. But now there wasn't time. She was crying like before when her grandmother was singing stories, but these were a different kind of tears. The world was terribly ill. She saw it all through the ocean. There was heartbreak without reason, without cause or understanding. She didn't want this boy to die. This time she could control it. She wouldn't just watch him die. And yet, what could she do against the brutal, gnawing cold? She stifled a sob and turned it into an exhale, and in a flash remembered her grandmother. So, gathering every little grain of what courage she had, the Selkie reached all of herself down into the sandy soil and out into the ocean and started to sing the first melody that came into her mind. Her voice was cracked and weak and her throat raw with salt, but she breathed deep and sang again, and the sound grew stronger. She lay her sealskin over the pale young human like a heavy blanket, pressing him into the sand. She sang of the fire under the earth that radiates up through rock and root to soft green leaves stretching skyward. She sang a prayer to the old woman of the world who lives beneath the bedrock, sacredly bound to keep and tend that flame. She sang of long, bright summer days when the surface of shallow coves gets positively balmy and a body could lay there for hours, elastic and luxurious. She sang the miracle of her sealskin, how it keeps back treacherous snow and retains all the heat of her blood. She sang to the god that was rain and of the life flowing through all. And most especially, she sang about the way her heart felt brightened when her family danced under the full-bellied moon, sharing stories by crackling flames. The pine smoke light and instant heat moved along her entirety, from the tips of her toes to behind her ears, under her silky black hair. She sang of her grandmother holding her. That she sang most of all, and the heat flowed to the human through her, like pattering rain through a clean, open gutter. His heart began to beat again, to open and to close. The boy shuddered and breathed, making a rattling cough. The Selkie held him tight then, until she couldn't stay any longer without fearing the cold herself. Exhausted and full of that subtle flame, she slid back on her seal coat and slipped into the sea. And for her, time moved on. She went back to her clan and faced consequences for risking her life for a human's. She went on being a seal. She thought about him sometimes, but he became a character in the story of what she'd been going through that night. And Kian, discovered barely breathing half an hour later by Sam the farmer's wife, bounced like a sack of potatoes in a rusty teal wheelbarrow, pushed up the sandy path on the way to a whole other life. This is a poem called Leftover Recipe Heartbreak. It really is astonishing how many times a person can lose everything. Forever optimistic, the human phenomenon, picking up loose stitches, quilting over holes. When was the last time the ground crumbled between old church block table legs, the sky bled through the horizon, and friends who could be counted on revealed molded secrets, thick with gangrene, recognizable only as opportunities too far gone? Oh, that was yesterday? Sounds about right. And yet, always surprising, the way it opens the heart, like the smell after rain, a cool, freshening downpour, purifying karma. What a gift to get to start from scratch again, to be unknown in a beautiful world, so eager to make mistakes and compost unfilled potential. Honestly, what a champion feeling when the absolute worst happens and then life goes on. The stories of shadowed, darker times, thick with menace and intrigue, cigarette-smoking private eyes from the 1960s, lurking in the corners, sick with hangdog eyes, can stay there, dirtying the carpet. Everything I cared about that was so sacred to me, left with too much abandon to be really what I thought. True hearts survive the breaking, and when they break, break open. Bring on the sunrise, the oldest reliable friend, and that glimpse of moonlight, and how cold it feels at midnight at any time of year. The music of solidarity between night and day, all of that everything a person cannot lose because they are a part of it, unless that's lost to them. What a mystery, one more time, to find that it is good news. Losing whatever it was I fear losing the most has every time seemed to leave me better off. And I hope, not a mystery I'll have to study again, said the hydrogen atom to the sun. This last piece is an excerpt from a project I've been working on with my dear friend Juliet. It's called Numinous, and we're releasing it as a podcast and an audiobook. It chronicles a pilgrimage that we took to forgotten sacred sites in Italy, France, and a few in England and Wales. This excerpt is from one of my favorite destinations on that trip, the Pechmerel Caves in France, where there are 30,000-year-old cave paintings. And at this moment in the episode, we've been going deeper into the caves and taking in the paintings, and then come across a footprint that was left by a child before the Ice Age, which closed the caves, and they were only reopened in the early 1900s. We climb a bit and stop on a sort of ledge looking down over the long, thin cave we just walked through. There's a little more lighting here, clustered around a flat, rough textured patch between the stones. The guide explains that here, in this hardened mud, there is the footprint of a child from before the last ice age. There's another print near it where an electrician stumbled putting up the lights, and she points out how different the mark they made is. The rim of it is sharp, broken, and dusty. You can tell the earth was dry when the electrician stepped there, but the child's print is perfect. Rounded curves, no dust, so it could only have been imprinted there when it was still muddy. This footprint strikes me most of all. A child, maybe exploring way, way back in the cave, trying to get up high, leaving a single print, maybe being surprised by the mud between their toes, laughing, hearing the sound echo. Why have I never pictured early humans laughing? And then when the guide starts to explain the contrast of the ancient footprint with the electrician's one, I want to start crying. She has a look in her eye and a note in her voice, this slight, jaded, defensive undertone. Wow, people must genuinely need to be convinced that this is real for her to have to explain it like this. People must come in this whole cave system and think it's all been faked. Why? There's been so much erasure of ancestry, and it makes sense in recent centuries because of all the crimes people want to cover up, but this contact with the human past is the most beautiful, mysterious, heart-opening experience. I've never even imagined it could feel like this, to meet them through these caverns. They're brilliant, intelligent, with such specific flavor. Their intimacy with the world, their comfort with great mysteries. It's still tangible for me, here. Still familiar as seeing pre-dawn light and knowing that it's morning. I can fathom the edges of their consciousness. Just the edges of it. But the resonance, the general shape, it's here. It's alive. It's profound. What went wrong? Was there an original trauma that started all this disconnect? It seems like around the end of the last ice age and the start of farming practices, something set off this extremely destructive, toxic, like, reaction to trauma, and we're still getting hit by the ripples like tidal waves. and every time washed farther out to sea and farther away from the source. And the waves are getting more and more extreme, to the level of mass extinction events and potentially full ecosystem collapse, and what happened might have been something really small and indistinct, but it was about us and ourselves and our relationship with our ancestors and their relationship with the earth. It doesn't make sense to me that people started doing agriculture so they'd have more free time. Farming is hard work. And cultures around the world, throughout time, have been able to make beautiful art and music and divine interaction and intellectual expansion without breaking their roots or setting the plow. I don't understand. We turned on the old ways with such cruelty and violence and such an intense commitment to domination. That could only come from trauma. Nothing comes from nothing. Maybe it was a famine or a pandemic. Maybe it was simply overpopulation that tipped us out of balance with the ecosystem. An original invasive species growing too well, eating up habitat and resources to meet our own exponential needs. What if it was that? But then there are how many hundreds of thousands of years of humans navigating chaos and tragedy without it getting stuck in their nervous systems in that unshakable way of PTSD, like modern traumas do? Why did that begin? And with so much momentum, so much tenacity. Maybe I don't need to know. Maybe that's the medicine of this place. I don't need to know, to feel it. The wisdom of these people who walked and painted here. I can hear their children laughing. Maybe the soul who made that footprint was my great, 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 great grand someone. Maybe their light, their courage, their spiritedness still lives in my veins, and I don't need to explain it to remember. I don't need to know to start trying to live more like them. I do hope somebody figures it out, but this can be my answer.
To explore our books, free poems, event information, recordings of our readings, visit galleryofreaders.org. Come visit us online. And if you can, share a little abundance, because we're a nonprofit and exist through this community. We would love to see you at a reading or hear about a book you're enjoying right now or learn of writers we should meet and interview and hear more from. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon with another local author. Until then.